Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. East County is home to many Iraqi immigrants who are watching events in the Middle East with great concern. We'll have the latest on the fast-moving battles involving the Islamic State or ISIS on today's show. Craft beer is a major industry in California, and a new ballot initiative would create craft cannabis. Stay tuned for details. On our local government report today, we'll tell you about some items of note on the Lemon Grove and Santee City Council agendas for this week. We've got some good news today about the measles outbreak in California, and then hear who's exempted from the governor's order to cut water use and why some Californians are objecting. On Crime Beat, hear about two East County members of the National Guard accused of illegal weapons sales. On Green Scene, learn about a major new connection planned by the county and the city of Poway to link up a network of trails throughout our mountain areas. On Sounds of History, we have an interview today with Ken Woodward, a descendant of pioneers in Ramona, and the curator of the Guy Woodward Museum in Ramona, which is an amazing historical treasure. We'll tell you about four finalists in a national competition that seeks to put a woman on the $20 bill, including a Cherokee chief, a civil rights activist, an international human rights advocate, and a conductor on the Underground Railroad. We'll also tell you about Winona LaDuc, a prominent indigenous and environmental rights leader who will be speaking at San Diego State University on Earth Day. Also today, hear about a flasher in Santee, a fight to save honeybees, a baby food recall, and a new bill to require energy standards for computers. Plus, hear about a free composting class in Lemon Grove and a new study on women in poverty. And then we'll take you on the road to the Desert View Tower, and we'll have tips on how to attract hummingbirds and butterflies to your garden, all on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. San Diego's East County is home to one of the nation's largest populations of Iraqi immigrants and refugees who watch with heavy hearts as violence continues to tear their homeland asunder. Here are some of the latest developments in the onslaught by the Islamic State or ISIS in the Middle East. Thousands of Iraqis fled the city of Ramadi over the weekend as ISIS forces advanced, raining bombs on the city. Ramadi is considered at risk of falling to ISIS, the Washington Post reports. Senator John McCain has criticized the Pentagon for downplaying the importance of Ramadi. General Martin Dempsey has called the battle to regain control of an oil refinery at Baji a more strategic target. Early Sunday, Iraqi forces did recapture control of the Baji refinery, Iraqi military commander Abdel Wahab al-Sadi told Associated Press. 2 days earlier, Iraqi soldiers, backed by U.S.-led coalition airstrikes and Shiite and Sunni assistance, gained control of the towns of al-Maha and al-Mazra. In the Kurdish city of Erbil, ISIS is being blamed for car bombings that killed 3 people. An Iraqi provincial governor announced on Friday that the highest-ranking official from Saddam Hussein's regime, still at large, now believed to be dead, the New York Times reports. A body believed to be Izzat Ibrahim al-Duri will be DNA tested to confirm the identity. However, there have been several false reports of Duri's death in the past. And in the Afghanistan city of Halabad, a suicide bomber, believed to be with ISIS, set off a blast outside a bank, killing 33 people and injuring over 100 on Saturday, according to Reuters News. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
First came craft beer, a booming business in California. Could craft cannabis be next? It could happen. The California Craft Cannabis Act would legalize marijuana use statewide and establish a California Cannabis Commission responsible for setting up licensing requirements for craft growers, commercial growers, retailers, and processors. It was submitted by attorneys Omar Figueroa and Heather Burke. The measure would also allow substantial taxation, up to 30%. The craft cannabis measure has financial backing from the owners of weedmaps.com, which publishes an online directory of medical marijuana dispensaries. Another proposed ballot measure, Californians for Compassionate and Sensible Access, would override local restrictions on medical marijuana. If California moves to legalize recreational marijuana, it will follow in the footsteps of Colorado and Washington State, where recreational marijuana is already legal. The District of Columbia has also legalized marijuana, but only for home use, not in public places. Marijuana remains illegal under federal law and remains classified as a Schedule I drug, though the Obama administration has backed off on enforcement in states that have legalized cannabis. For East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Miriam Raftery with this week's local government report for East County. Lemon Grove's City Council meets on Tuesday, April 21st at 6 p.m. Now here's the buzz. This week, the council will consider possible beekeeping regulations. Santee City Council meets Wednesday, April 22nd at 7 p.m. The agenda includes a public hearing on a proposed rezoning regarding the addition of 16 mobile home spaces on the east side of Railroad Avenue between Mission Gorge and Buena Vista. There will also be a hearing to review a draft report on impediments to fair housing, as well as hearings on issues related to community development block grants. You can find the full agendas at your city websites and additional information at eastcountymagazine.org.
The California Department of Public Health on Friday declared the measles outbreak officially over. The outbreak, which began at Disneyland, infected 131 people in California, including 14 in San Diego County. The Disneyland outbreak also spread to other states, causing 142 cases in seven states from late December to early March. There have been no new cases confirmed in California since March 2nd. Most of the cases in California and across the nation occurred in people who did not get vaccinated. The measles vaccine is 97% effective if both doses are received. Due to a rise in children who have not been vaccinated, the County of San Diego recently changed its policy to require that if a parent seeks a personal belief exemption from vaccination requirements for their children, the form must be signed by a healthcare professional as well as the parent or guardian. The state legislature is considering a bill that would eliminate the personal belief exemption, requiring that all children receive vaccinations unless there is a documented health condition, such as an allergy to an ingredient in a vaccine, or certain underlying health conditions. For East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson with the Health Report.
California Governor Jerry Brown last week ordered the first ever mandatory water restrictions in state history, and the State Water Resources Control Board is imposing an immediate 25% reduction in water use among the 400 local water agencies around the state. But Patrick Sullivan with the Center for Biological Diversity says the governor failed to include oil and gas exploration in his water cutback order, despite the massive amounts of water used in fracking operations.
The oil industry is using some 2 million gallons of water a day in California for fracking and for other types of oil extraction. And much of that water is contaminated and taken out of the water cycle for good.
Much of the area affected by fracking is in the southern San Joaquin Valley near Bakersfield, where Sullivan says frackers are often working in areas near farmers who, once again this year, are not receiving any water deliveries from the state because of the drought. Sullivan says most fracking in California uses fresh water that could otherwise be put to use for drinking water or farming. He says the water situation has become so severe that in some cases, farmers are using wastewater from oil operations on their crops. And that isn't all.
There are hundreds of oil industry disposal wells that are dumping contaminated oil waste into aquifers in places like Monterey County and Los Angeles and Kern County right now across the state.
Sullivan says the state has done a poor job of providing oversight and says California doesn't have effective rules regulating water use by the oil industry.
There are now some rules requiring disclosure of where they're getting water for fracking and what they're doing with wastewater after they're done. But there are no real restrictions on how much water they use and where it comes from.
California typically receives more than one-third of its water supply from melting snow in the Sierra Nevada mountain range, where this year the annual snowpack was measured at a record low of 8% of the normal snowfall in an average year. For Public News Service, I'm Tommy Howe.
This is Leon Thompson with a Crime Beat Report. Two Army National Guard soldiers from East County were arrested last week and charged with selling weaponry, including assault rifles, ammunition, and body armor, to undercover agents who posed as Mexican drug cartel members. The Los Angeles Times reports that suspects Jaime Casillas of El Cajon and Sergeant Andrew Reyes of Mesa wore their uniforms during at least one transaction, which means they can be prosecuted under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Reyes allegedly purchased some of the weapons in Texas and boasted to the undercover agent that a pistol had been used to do a job in Mexico. Other items were from a United States military inventory, court documents indicate. The pair faced charges of dealing in firearms without a federal license. Reyes is also charged with unlawful transportation of weapons. Each count carries a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
The County of San Diego and the City of Poway are teaming up on an ambitious proposal to connect the region's vast network of hiking and equestrian trails and other popular outdoor attractions. The Poway City Council and the County Board of Supervisors, in separate votes last week, agreed to work together to seek grant money and other funds to buy as many as 800 acres of open space near Iron Mountain on the eastern edge of Poway. Supervisor Diane Jacob says we have a tremendous opportunity to close a crucial gap in our trail system and open up more of our beautiful backcountry to the public. The land acquisition would officially link Iron Mountain, Dos Picos Park, Mount Woodson, and Lake Poway via trails that would include a pedestrian and wildlife bridge over State Route 67. The bridge would tie together existing paths spanning the length of the county. Poway Mayor Steve Voss observes, "For decades, there's been a missing link between far-flung trails, parks, and open space. Connecting these treasures would be hailed by hikers, equestrians, and nature lovers now and for generations to come as a master stroke. The land purchase would preserve additional wildlife space in the Poway area and expand recreational opportunities for residents and visitors." The ambitious vision includes a bridge built over Highway 67 to allow people to hike and ride all three of Poway's storied peaks, Blue Sky, Mount Woodson, with its famous potato chip rock, and Iron Mountain, all in one day without ever leaving the trail, notes Poway Councilman Jim Cunningham. The Poway City Council approved its partnership with the county on April 7th. The Board of Supervisors backed the agreement the next day. The PAC says they will pursue funding sources to purchase additional open space in the Iron Mountain vicinity. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, guest hosting the Sounds of History, recording on the road today in Ramona. We are at the Guy B. Woodward Museum in Ramona, which is a marvelous place, and it is my great pleasure today to introduce our special guest, Ken Woodward, who is the curator of the museum. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
Now, I understand that your own family has long roots in Ramona. Tell us a little bit about your own family history first, and then we'll talk about the museum.
Yes, my family came out of Kellogg, Iowa. They came to Ramona in 1896, and the whole family, aunts, uncles, grandfather, grandmother, kids, girlfriends, the whole group. Two of them, they were actually farmers and dairymen out of Kellogg, Iowa.
And so what brought them to California, and how did they get here?
Well, they had lived in Iowa for many, many years, and they were just simply getting tired of the harsh winters and trying to take care of their farms and cattle. And so the whole family just packed up and came westward. That was my great-grandfather and all of his brothers and sisters.
Now, I understand that your family has quite the history here in Ramona. Can you give us a couple of highlights?
Yes, my family, they were farmers and dairymen, and later my dad and his six brothers and sisters became very attached to Ramona. They grew up here. My dad's brother became a very famous historical archaeologist and historian, and My dad moved on in the 1930s and became chief of police in Oceanside, where he finished his years.
Now, let's hear about the museum.
The primary purpose of the museum was to commemorate the old-timers in Ramona, and they came here, they began coming here in about 1870.
Now, Ken, I understand that when your father was putting this whole marvelous museum together with all these different buildings, that he got some help from somebody who had a lot of experience in stage set design. Tell us about that.
Yes, he was very fortunate. Mr. Bill Cowan had moved to Ramona, and he had retired, and Bill Cowan was actually worked for Walt Disney Studios, and he built sets and built towns for Walt Disney Studios. So when my dad got ready to begin building some of the old barns and everything, he was very glad to help.
Yeah, this really does look like you've been plopped down and reincarnated in the middle of the Old West here with all these wonderful buildings. The centerpiece of it is the Theophile Verlaki House.
Yes.
And that was built, I understand, in 1886?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the house and how it came to be built.
Yes, Theophile Verlaki, he was a Basque from southern France. And at the time he left France in 1870 to come to the New World, to make his living. The whole Verlaki family came in to New Orleans, and then he found his way in 1870 to San Diego. And he became very prominent in San Diego. He built several businesses there, became one of the largest wine producers in San Diego.
Wow, so Ramona's wine industry has roots that go all the way back to the 1800s. Very interesting. And today it's certainly a thriving business up here. What can people see if they go into the Verlaki house today?
Well, I always tell people that they need to understand that everything they see here on this property has all been donated, mainly because the museum is a nonprofit organization. And when they go into that beautiful home, and it is all adobe, and they will find it beautifully furnished with all donated furniture, with all kinds of books in the library, with all kinds of furnishings in throughout.
And there's also a doctor's office. Tell us about that.
And there's a really interesting doctor's office. One of the bedrooms has been converted into a doctor's office. And that is, we have very old medical equipment that actually goes back to the 1800s that doctors have been donating to the museum. And it's really fascinating to see these old pieces of equipment.
There's also some very ornate furnishings. There's a fabulous antique grand piano in there, an old pump organ, a Victrola, and in one of the back bedrooms, I understand there's a bedroom set with an interesting history too, very ornate.
Yes, the bedroom set is brought in to the museum in 1980, and this lady came in and said, I'd like to donate this beautiful bedroom set. It was built in 1840 back in Connecticut, but she said, you need to know who I am. She said, first of all, I'm part of the Yale family, the producers of the Yale Lock Company, and my great-great-grandfather in 1840 was the person who put together the Yale Lock Company.
Now, there's a lot more than just a vintage home on this property, however. You have amassed an amazing collection of some of the original buildings here in Ramona. Folks, if you come out here to the museum, the Guy B. Woodward Museum, you can see a vintage schoolhouse, a blacksmith shop, a barn, buggies, all kinds of interesting buildings, covered wagon, and also a jail. Now, I understand there's a really colorful history behind that jail. Tell us about it.
The jail was actually built in San Diego about 1890, and the jail was brought up here, 7 tons of iron, brought up to Ramona, and installed as the Ramona Jail. And then it, in the 1930s, it disappeared. And
so the jail was stolen?
No. The county of San Diego started using it for a dynamite storage, and it was found in a canyon and brought back to the museum.
Now, I understand that your mother used to have a job related to the jail.
Actually, that was my grandmother. And my grandmother, back in the early late 1800s, her job was to feed the prisoners, and she got 15 cents a day to bring them broth in.
And it has now been restored and brought back here to Ramona, and you can see it if you come out to visit the Guy B. Woodward Museum. Now, there's some other interesting buildings here. We're doing the interview actually sitting here in an old barn. What's the history of this?
Actually, it was one of my dad's ideas to bring in all of the old barns and all the old buildings that he could to the museum property. This barn was built in 1870. It was built by the Barnett family who came into Ramona from San Francisco area.
Looks like it's set up for meetings. Do you hold different kinds of meetings or events in here nowadays?
Yes. Every other month we have a potluck, and people are simply invited to bring something that they can share with everyone else. And we come in here and we have speakers on history and Ramona and things of this nature. It's really very good.
What fun. That's just an amazing resource to find. This place is a veritable treasure trove. As you walk through, you see antique dolls and vintage clothing and furnishings and tools. And there was a very interesting giant cook pot out there. Tell us about that.
The cook pot actually belonged to the Ortega family. And the Ortega family came to the valley in 1843. And they actually owned all 17,000 acres here in the valley.
So this was the family that received the land through the original Spanish land grant.
That's correct. And so the Ortegas proceeded to use the valley for farming all kinds of wheat and everything.
Now, of course, long before the original settlers came here, we had the Native Americans, the Kumeyaay people. I understand you have some Native American artifacts that people can see here as well.
Yes, the Kumeyaay Indians came to the valley 2,000 years ago, and we have some beautiful Indian artifacts, a whole display in the basement from that tribe.
Wow, I would love to take a look at that. And I understand, by the way, that the Kumeyaay now say they trace their history in the San Diego region back 10 to 12,000 years. Interesting, they've recently found some artifacts in some other areas that suggest they may have been here even a lot longer than that. There are also a lot of interesting vehicles here. I see some vintage buggies, you know, like horse-drawn buggies, and what looks like a Conestoga wagon or covered wagon out there. What can you tell us about those?
Yes, the one large wagon that we have, it seats about 12 people, and it used to take all the people that came into Lakeside into Julian. It took 12 hours for that wagon to take 12 people from Lakeside to Julian.
My goodness, how times have changed. And the kids think they have it rough now. Now, when your father was first getting started and putting this all together, there was another benefactor from San Diego who came along. He was the owner of San Diego Trust and Savings. Can you give us some details?
Yes, Mr. Thomas W. Sefton stopped by to see my dad one time and introduced himself, and my dad took him all the way through the museum and told him what he intended to do, and Mr. Sefton said, "Guy, tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to donate my mining equipment to the museum," which he did later on.
Yeah, and your father started this back in the 1980s or so, and then I understand that after he passed on and after Mr. Sefton passed on, the mantle kind of fell to you, and you came along and went downtown to retrieve all the mining equipment.
Yes, we were very fortunate because the Sefton family gave me a call one day, and they said, "Ken, I understand that our father promised to give you all of the mining equipment from the Colorado, California, Nevada gold mines." And I said, "Yes, he did." And they said, "Well, come down and get it."
What else did you find when you went down there?
First of all, they directed me to a warehouse next on Marina Boulevard, right next to the train tracks. And so I went down, knocked on the door, took a look, and the train tracks actually came into this large barn area, and Mr. Sefton's own personal railroad car was there.
What those very wealthy travelers used to use to go cross-country in the olden days. Now, he also donated some other interesting things. I see a tall ship replica down here. What else?
Well, in addition to the ship replica, it's difficult to believe, but he also donated the keys to Mount Vernon, George Washington's house. And that has always been a very interesting display.
Well, there you go. That's amazing. What else could people see that you would like people to know about the museum and the facilities here?
Well, the way the museum is put together, I think, is the most important, because all of a sudden the centerpiece is the Verlac House, built in 1886. You have a full-size basement, which is filled with beautiful artifacts. Then we have adorned on, my dad had brought in all of these buildings from the 1870s, and he reconstructed them here on the property. We're sitting in an old barn that was built in 1870.
It's amazing. It's really one of those little-known treasures we have out here in East County that I think a lot of people don't know about and would love to visit if they could. Now, speaking of visiting, when is the museum open to the public?
The museum is open to the public as advertised Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 1 to 4 o'clock. However, the museum is also open Monday through Thursday. We have one of our workers here, and they will open up the museum to anyone that desires to come in during the week.
Well, that's a good tip for our listeners here at East County Magazine. I know it's run by a nonprofit organization. So if people have maybe old artifacts out there from the Ramona area in their basements or attics, who would they get in touch with if they have something they may wish to donate?
They would get in touch with our main office here on the grounds and describe what they would like to donate to see if we can use it and see if it fits in. And that has been done. You'll be surprised at the number of artifacts that we have here that are local to Ramona.
Wonderful. So if you want to visit the museum, you can visit their website at www.woodwardmuseum.org. Ken, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I'm going to give you the last word here. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about the Woodward Museum or the history of Ramona?
Well, I think it's really interesting. We have people from all over the world going through this museum. People coming in to visit California, they hear about the museum, they come up and they get a wonderful trip through the museum.
And it's located right on Main Street here in the heart of downtown Ramona today. Ken, I want to thank you very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you very much, and it's been a delight talking to you.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
This is Leon Thompson with an update on womenon20s.org. Efforts to have a woman's image replace Andrew Jackson on a $20 bill. The group held a national vote for the public to choose among 15 candidates. Now the field has been narrowed to four. Three were chosen by popular vote: Rosa Parks, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Harriet Tubman. The fourth, Wilma Mankiller, was added by popular demand to include a Native American option to replace Jackson, a former general and president. President Jackson ordered the forced relocation of Cherokee Indians off their land, causing deaths of 4,000 in what became known as the Cherokee Trail of Tears. Mankiller, fittingly, was a Cherokee chief noted for her accomplishments to help the Cherokee people. Here are highlights of all four finalists. Wilma Mankiller was the first woman elected a Native American nation leader in modern times. Her great-grandfather survived the Cherokee Trail of Tears. Born in 1945 as one of 11 children, she was raised on an Oklahoma reservation in a home without electricity, indoor plumbing, or phones. After her family moved to San Francisco, she became involved in the Indian rights movement and became coordinator of Indian programs for Oakland Public Schools. After divorce, she took her daughters back to Oklahoma and married a full-blooded Cherokee. She founded the Community Development Department for the Cherokee Nation, making dramatic improvements in housing and the community water system. She initially was elected as deputy chief, but when the chief left office to head up the United States Bureau of Indian Affairs, Mankiller became chief of the Cherokee Nation. She was later reelected twice, earning 83% of the vote, the second time in 1991. In her three terms, she tripled her tribe's enrollment, doubled employment, and built new housing, health centers, and children's programs. Infant mortality fell, and educational accomplishments rose. In 1990, she signed a historic self-determination agreement in which the Bureau of Indian Affairs surrendered direct control to the tribe over millions of dollars in federal funding. Her leadership made her a national role model. She remained a strong voice worldwide for social justice, Native people, and women after she left office in 1995. In 1993, she was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame, and in 1998, she received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest honor bestowed upon civilians in the United States. In her autobiography, Man Killer, A Chief and Her People, she wrote that she wanted to be remembered for emphasizing that Cherokee values can help solve contemporary problems. Rosa Parks, a seamstress, became known as the mother of the freedom movement after she refused to give up her seat and move to the back of the bus for a white passenger in Montgomery, Alabama in 1955. Her act of civil disobedience and the resulting Montgomery bus boycott helped spark the success of the civil rights movement. Parks collaborated with civil rights leaders, including Martin Luther King Jr., as an organizer of civil rights actions. Raised with grandparents who were former slaves, as a child, she had witnessed Ku Klux Klan activities and attended a segregated school. She later became head of a local NAACP chapter aiming to end discrimination. For her own defiance in refusing to give up her bus seat to a white man, she was arrested and found guilty. But the events she set in motion led to the United States Supreme Court declaring Alabama's bus segregation law unconstitutional a year later. Parks and her husband lost their jobs due to their arrest and the court battles. They moved to Detroit, where she worked for Congressman John Conyers for many years. In 2013, President Barack Obama unveiled a statue honoring Parks in the U.S. Capitol, stating, "In a single moment, with the simplest of gestures, she helped change America and change the world." Eleanor Roosevelt was First Lady during her husband Franklin Delano Roosevelt's presidency, working to address the needs of women and minorities through a newspaper column and radio broadcast. She was the first president's wife to take an active role. Later, she became a delegate to the United Nations, where she championed human rights. President Harry Truman dubbed her the First Lady of the World. Born into wealth, she suffered the tragic loss of her brother and both parents by age 10 when she was shipped off to boarding school in England and was deeply influenced by its feminist headmistress. After marrying Roosevelt, she soon found herself raising six children and serving as wife of the Assistant Secretary of the Navy during World War I, speaking at patriotic rallies and working with the Red Cross, also visiting wounded soldiers and working to improve conditions for the mentally ill. She supported her husband after he contracted polio, often campaigning on his behalf during the Depression and later World War II. She fought for equal pay legislation, child labor limits, civil rights, and women's rights. When Daughters of the American Revolution refused to allow African-American singer Miriam Anderson to perform in their Constitution Hall, the First Lady resigned her membership. After her husband's death as the U.S. delegate to the United Nations, she successfully fought for passage of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, helping people around the world. Harriet Tubman has been called the Moses of her time. An escaped slave born in the 1820s, she became a leading abolitionist before the Civil War, risking her freedom to return to the South 19 times to rescue slaves via the Underground Railroad, a network of secret safe houses on their journey to freedom in the North. Later, she served as a scout and spy for the Union Army. In her childhood, she saw her father freed and many of her brothers and sisters sold off. At 13, she refused to help restrain an escaped slave who had been captured and suffered a blow to the head that left her with seizures the rest of her life. She fled in 1848 and soon came back to rescue her own family and others, never losing a single passenger on the road to freedom. Also a gifted healer, she helped nurse those who were wounded. After the war, she advocated for freed slaves to receive an education and own property, also joining the fight for women's equality and the right to vote. called General Tubman by her admirers, she was laid to rest with full military honors as one of the first African-American women to serve in the military. You can cast your vote at womenon20s.org. The winning choice will be sent to President Barack Obama with a request that he instruct his Treasury Secretary to make the change in honor of the upcoming 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment that gave women the right to vote. Congressional approval is not required to change the faces on U.S. currency. WomenOn20s.org considered dozens of candidates before narrowing the field to 15, and now 4. No living women were eligible, since United States laws require that only people who have been dead at least 2 years may be honored with their images on currency. Two women have been honored on coins: suffrage leader Susan B. Anthony and Sacagawea, a Native American guide who led explorations by Lewis and Clark through the American West. With the slogan, "A woman's place is on the money," WomenOn20s.org hopes to convince the president that the time is right to recognize the accomplishments of a woman on a $20 bill. This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting today's Tribal Beat. Internationally acclaimed Native American and environmental activist Winona LaDuke will be the keynote speaker at San Diego State University's Green Fest on April 22nd. She will appear at Montezuma Hall in the Conrad Prebys Student Center at 4:30 p.m. The speech is free and open to the public. LaDuke is the executive director of Honor the Earth, the largest indigenous environmental organization in North America, and the author of 6 books. She is an Anishinaabe from the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. LaDuke also served as Ralph Nader's vice presidential running mate on the Green Party ticket in the 1996 and 2000 presidential elections. In 2007, she was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. And she just happens to be a cousin of East County Magazine's Tribal Beat host, Leon Thompson. In 1994, Time Magazine named Winona LaDuke one of America's 50 most promising leaders under age 40. In 1997, LaDuke was named Ms. Magazine Woman of the Year. She has also received the Reebok Human Rights Award, the Global Green Award, and the International Slow Food Award for working to protect local biodiversity. In her own community in Minnesota, she is the founder of the White Earth Land Recovery Project, one of the largest reservation-based nonprofits in the nation, working to protect indigenous plants and heritage foods such as wild rice from patenting and genetic engineering. LaDuke is a graduate of Harvard University with graduate work at MIT and Antioch University. Also a rural development economist, she has testified at numerous forums as an expert witness, and she's a lead plaintiff in Honor the Earth versus Kerry, a lawsuit against the U.S. State Department for an approval process of a tar sands pipeline. With Honor the Earth, she works nationally and internationally on issues of climate change, renewable energy, sustainable development, food systems, and environmental justice. GreenFest is a week-long series of events focused on sustainability, presented by San Diego State's Associated Students and Enviro Business Society. LaDuke's speech is slated for April 22nd, which is, appropriately, Earth Day. And you can get more information on GreenFest and Winona LaDuke's appearance there at sdsu.edu.
A man wearing a skirt entered several Santee businesses last Wednesday and then lifted his skirt to show his underwear to women present. One hairdresser at Hair It Is, etc. told 10 News the man seemed mental and was asked to leave. He then went to an Allstate insurance office and repeated the actions. Employees who notified the sheriff's office say the flasher drove an older white Chevrolet pickup truck. This has been Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
Save the bees. That's the battle cry in 2 ongoing court cases in California, where beekeepers and environmental groups are fighting regulators over the use of pesticides they contend harm bees and crops. On Tuesday, on behalf of the groups, the law firm Earth Justice asked a federal judge in San Francisco to make the EPA take a second look at a pesticide called sulfoxaflor. Lead attorney Greg Laurie says this is the first case beekeepers have brought against the agency for failing to protect honeybees from toxic pesticides.
It's gotten to the point where beekeepers are losing so many bees each year that they simply can't stay in business. At the rate we're going, we're really on the short path to agricultural disaster.
Last week, Earth Justice asked a state court in Alameda to force the California Department of Pesticide Regulation to stop approving the use of a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids until the department finishes a multi-year review of the impacts on honeybees. Groups opposed to and in favor of pesticide use both cite studies they say prove their respective points. Pesticide manufacturers blame the bee deaths on a combination of causes, including disease and predators. But no matter what the cause, Paul Towers of the Pesticide Action Network says the stakes are high.
We know that bees are responsible for 1 in 3 bites of food we eat. So we need to take every step we can to ensure their continued safety and protection.
California's state review of neonicotinoids began in 2009, and Tower says that's long enough to take some meaningful action to protect bees. The bees play a beneficial role in many farm crops, but at greatest risk in California is the $3 billion almond crop, which is entirely dependent on bees for pollination. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Ed Barreno with a Consumer Health Alert. Beech Nut Nutrition is recalling nearly 2,000 pounds of baby food products that may be contaminated with small pieces of glass, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Service has announced. The recalled products are Stage 2 Beech Nut Classics, sweet potato and chicken, in 4-ounce glass jars. The baby foods were produced on December 12, 2014 and expire December 2016. These products were shipped nationwide. Recalled items have the number P68A inside the USD inspection mark. The problem was discovered after Beech Nut received a complaint from a consumer who found a small piece of glass in the product. The company has also received a report of an oral injury linked to consumption of its baby food. The federal government has received no other reports of injury or illness from consumption of these products. Anyone concerned about an injury or illness should contact a healthcare provider. Consumers with questions about the recall can contact the Beech Nut Consumer Hotline at 866-674-4446.
California may soon become the first state in the nation to set minimum energy standards for home digital devices like computers, monitors, modems, and video game consoles. These machines use a lot of electricity, even when they're off, and we're using them more than 5 times as often as we did in 2001. The California Energy Commission is debating new rules for digital energy efficiency at a public workshop on Wednesday in Sacramento. Mark Cooper with the Consumer Federation of America applauds California's leadership on this issue.
Somebody has to step up and say, we need to do this. When California acts, it tends to get the industry's attention and to force the industry to think hard. And once they meet the standard in California, they end up selling more efficient devices every place.
Last fall, the governor vetoed an industry-supported bill that would have made rules like these non-binding. The Consumer Electronics Association, a trade group, says the standards would be too costly and are unnecessary, citing the success of voluntary initiatives like the EPA's Energy Star program. The state says the standards would drive up costs somewhat. For example, consumers could pay about $5 more for a computer monitor, but they'd save $26 on their power bill over the life of the device. Cooper says manufacturers are able to make the changes.
You got the technology, they know how to do it, and there's this clear market failure. And so the standard raises the level of all the devices.
Those who can't be at the workshop can watch it online at the California Energy Commission's website. The deadline to submit written comments is 4 p.m. tomorrow. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region. Please support KNSJ by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Bill Driscoll with a report from Lemon Grove about a free composting class coming up that can help you save water and have a healthier garden. If you're like many backyard gardeners, you planted green beans, snap peas, tomatoes, chard, and zucchini, then stood back and waited for the good times to roll. After those first few crops withered and died, you were left with baseball bat-sized zucchini. Now the Lemon Grove Organic Garden Club and the Lemon Grove Historical Society have a solution for you. They're holding a free composting class on May 2nd from 1 to 3 p.m. outdoors in Lemon Grove Civic Center Park between Main and Olive Streets next to the historic H. Lee House. Led by master composter Marianne West, founder of the Garden Club, this class will teach you easy ways to compost household scraps and clippings. You'll also learn why compost makes stronger, pest-resistant, productive plants, and here's the kicker, saves water. A composted plant doesn't need to be watered nearly as often as plants without compost. Plus, you'll be recycling household foods and yard waste instead of filling up landfills. Helen Ofield, president of the Lemon Grove Historical Society, says compost will also result in earthworms becoming a fisherman's paradise. Guests are welcome to bring the kids on May 2nd and learn how to grow a bumper crop of veggies worth winning trophies at the county fair.
Just in time for Equal Pay Day on April 14th, the Nonprofit Institute for Women's Policy Research has released a new report showing that women have higher rates of poverty and much lower rates of business ownership than men in all 50 states, despite having made significant progress over the last 25 years in attaining a college education. This trend is especially pronounced among the youngest workers. Millennial women are considerably more likely than their male counterparts to have a bachelor's degree or higher. 36.3% of women have a bachelor's degree, compared with only 28.3% of those millennial men. And yet, millennial women have lower earnings than men in all but one state and higher rates of poverty than millennial men in every state in the nation. The report analyzed four indicators to create the Poverty and Opportunity Composite Index: educational attainment, business ownership, poverty, and access to health insurance coverage. Overall, the status of women with respect to poverty and opportunity has worsened in the majority of states in the last decade, though in 21 states and the District of Columbia, women's status in these areas has improved. Heidi Hartman, president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, says despite their significant educational progress, women remain more economically vulnerable than men, and this is especially true for millennials who represent the future of our labor market and economy. She adds, the inequality between women's and men's wages and their differential poverty rates at all ages and educational levels is a significant part of the income inequality story that is not being told. Across the United States, 15.5% of all women live in poverty, compared with 11.9% of men. Native American, Black, and Hispanic women are all more than twice as likely to live in poverty as white women. The poverty rate is highest among Native American women at over 28%. If all working women received equal pay with men who were of the same age, have the same level of education, and work the same number of hours, and have the same urban-rural status, the report concludes that the poverty rate for working women in the United States would be cut by more than half, declining from 8.1% to 3.9%. Today, women are slightly more likely than men to hold bachelor's degrees, but women's educational access is not distributed equally across racial and ethnic groups or by region. Only 1 in 6 Hispanic and Native American women hold a bachelor's degree, compared with nearly half of Asian Pacific Islander women and 1 in 3 white women. 1 in 3 Hispanic women has less than a high school diploma, which is more than 4 times the share of white women without a high school diploma. Barbara Galt, the vice president and executive director of IWPR, concludes, the persistent wage gap, even for women with bachelor's degrees, in addition to high female poverty rates and lack of educational access for Hispanic, Black, and Native American women, all point to the need for gender and race-sensitive approaches to addressing income inequality. The report also finds that women in the United States own a much smaller share of businesses than men. The proportion of women-owned businesses in the United States increased marginally, from 26% to 28.8% between 1997 and 2007, the most recent year for which federal data is available. The report finds substantial increase in women's health insurance coverage, however, following the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. From 2008 to 2014, the percentage of women ages 18 to 24 without health insurance decreased by over a third. Uninsurance rates for women of all ages dropped 18.5%, from 13% of women lacking insurance in 2008 to just over 10% in the first 9 months of 2014. Poverty rates also vary considerably depending on whether women and men have children or not. Single mothers have the highest rates of poverty in every single state, compared with married men and women, single men, and women without children, as well as single fathers. Nationally, 43% of households headed by single mothers are living in poverty. That is nearly twice the poverty rate of households headed by single fathers and nearly three times the rate of poverty of single women without children. If working single mothers in the United States received equal pay, the very high poverty rates for families with a working single mother would be cut nearly in half, the study found. More data on poverty and opportunity among women can be found at statusofwomendata.org. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Hayden Parsley, on the road in Hacumba Hot Springs for East County Magazine. You can take a trip into California's past at the Desert View Tower, a quirky and whimsical relic of the past that is still open to the public here in San Diego's East County. Located just off Interstate 8 at the Incapa exit, the tower is poised on a rocky overlook surrounded by desert on all sides. Built in the 1920s by Bert Vaughn, a real estate tycoon who owned much of Hacumba, this 70-foot watchtower has become a tourist attraction and a local landmark on the outskirts of the small town known as Hacumba Hot Springs. Originally built to commemorate the area's rough pre-highway history, the tower houses a small museum filled with artifacts and oddities of California's history, including our region's Native American, Spanish, and pioneer past. The top floor of the tower is an observation deck, with a coin-fed telescope that provides a breathtaking view of Imperial Valley and the Anza Borrego Desert, though now somewhat marred by a wind farm. In 1950, a gift shop was added around the base of the tower. The shop still operates today and is filled with an eclectic mix of items such as geodes, gems and minerals, vintage postcards, historic and travel books on our region, arts and crafts items such as handmade Tecate tiles, onyx bookends, musical instruments, carved animal sculptures, and more. Roaming this area of the tower are the owner's many friendly dogs that add to the rustic charm of the location. You can also get a workout pumping a player piano while listening to old-time tunes. While I was there, the wind was gusting. It was a bit chilly and I wished I had a better coat when I reached the top. The owner says this is atypical though and that it is warm and sunny most days. The proprietor, Ben Schultz, has many colorful stories on East County's history, culture, and colorful characters, having operated the site for many years. Boulder Park at the Desert View Tower was created in 1933 by an unemployed engineer, Merle Ratcliffe, who was out of work during the Great Depression. He sculpted reptiles and fanciful animals out of the huge stone boulders. I didn't get a chance to tour these, which will be an adventure for another time.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. I'd like to talk today about some plants you can plant to bring in hummingbirds. Everybody loves them. Nobody wants to fill those feeders. They get ants in them. They get bees in them. They get mold in them. And someday I'll convince my husband to quit putting sugar water in them and feeding them because there's enough in my yard to keep every hummingbird in East County quite happy for quite a while. So what do you want to put in your yard that will bring in the hummingbirds? My favorite plant is a cultivar of a native plant. It is called Galvezia firecracker. If you go to most nurseries nowadays, this plant has become so popular that you can get it. Just ask for firecracker, which is different than Russellia. It's a Galvezia, G-A-L-V-E-Z-I-A. This is a plant that gets to be about 4 feet tall, 4 feet wide, and it has red tubular flowers. And that's the key, isn't it? Red tubular flowers. That's what brings in the hummingbirds. They love it. Can't stay away from them. This is a much more manageable and nice plant than the Cape honeysuckle with the big orange flowers and the plant that gets to be 15 feet tall and 20 feet wide and goes everywhere and is a big floppy mess. Try a firecracker and see what you think. You can grow it in the sun, in the shade, in part sun, in part shade, with a lot of water or with just a little bit of water, and it will be fine. I have a neighbor who grows it under pepper trees, and the gardeners come every week and prune them into little round balls, and they never really get to bloom, and those trees have suffered through that for the last few years without a single one of them dying. Now, that's what I would call an obliging plant. Another good plant that will bring in lots and lots of wildlife to your garden, and hummingbirds especially, is called California fuchsia. It's called Epilobium. Some of you may have known it in the past as Zauschneria. What a great name. So there's a good password for you, Zauschneria. Who's going to use a word like that for their password? Zauschnarias or Epilobiums, California fuchsia, are a gray plant and they have a bright orange-red tubular flower. Once again, great for hummingbirds, really keeps them happy. This is a plant that will actually spread slightly on its own and will get by even if something bad happens to the irrigation and nobody irrigates it for 6 weeks or 6 months. It won't die. It'll be fine. Anytime you go to a nursery, look around and look for the plants that have the red tubular flowers. That's the key to hummingbirds. Now, my friend Maureen Austin, who puts on the Sage and Songbirds Festival every year, says there's two kinds of wildlife attracting plants out there. There's ice cream cones, which we're talking about now. These are the tubular shaped flowers that the hummingbirds like. Or there's pizzas, and pizzas are the flat flowers, the daisy-type flowers, that you see butterflies landing on. If you think about butterfly bush, Buddleia, which brings in all sorts of cute little butterflies, it also is fragrant. It's known as summer lilac here, or butterfly bush. Then if you take a close look at those purple spikes that grow on that, that bring in the butterflies, you'll see a whole bunch of little bitty flowers. And that's what the butterflies are landing on. That's what they like. So that's a great one. Probably the best butterfly plant that you can come up with, though, is always going to be the butterfly weed, milkweed, Asclepias curassavica. It has orange and red flowers on it, and it just grows like a weed in your garden. Not invasive, just reseeds very effectively. You will know that you have succeeded when you see interesting-looking green caterpillars all over the plant, eating every leaf. In my garden, I pick them off and I move them to another milkweed after they eat all the leaves off one. I don't try to fight them because they're going to turn into monarch butterflies. So my garden is full of monarch butterflies, which I consider to be flying flowers. So keep in mind, butterfly milkweed is a great plant to add to your garden repertoire.
This is Miriam Raftery with a warning for taxpayers. Our dinner hour was interrupted twice recently by automated calls claiming to be from the IRS. The messages were intimidating, claiming we owed a tax debt and threatening dire consequences if we wouldn't pay up promptly. But the calls were scams, and so far, U.S. taxpayers have lost $14 million to these IRS robocall scammers. Some of the calls even appear to come from IRS headquarters, and the callers may even have convincing details, such as the IRS agent's ID number or your Social Security number. The IRS does not make collection phone calls. Never give any personal information or money to these tricksters. Instead, jot down the caller's number and other details and then report an IRS scam to treasury.gov. Consumers Union is taking action to try to halt these calls. They now have a petition that you can sign asking the major phone companies for free tools that will block these calls before they reach you.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.